Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we have the pleasure of welcoming Lars Christensen. He's joining us from Copenhagen, Denmark. He is an independent international economist. He also teaches at the Copenhagen Business School. Lars, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Please tell us a little bit about yourself, your advisory, and what you do professionally.
Well, I, as you, has a background in banking. I used to be a civil servant before joining Danske Bank in 2000. I was there for 15 years. Was head of emerging market research at Danske Bank. But I have a very keen interest in monetary matters and monetary policy. It's been something that essentially has been on my mind for 30 years, ever since reading Milton Friedman for the first time. I consider myself a monetarist, or as the name of my blog, a market monetarist. I've been blogging about monetary policy since 2010-11. And that is also what I'm advising on. I advise on monetary matters. I have been advising government, central banks, investors. But these days I'm doing actually quite a lot of AI advisory. I can see myself moving more and more towards micro numbers, micro data. But that's how the world is developing, that we're moving in that direction. But I'm still keeping a close eyes on monetary matters, global monetary matters. And that is also what I've been doing research on, both at Stellenbosch University in South Africa and in Copenhagen Business School in Denmark.
The Bitcoin Layer is sponsored by River. Make sure to check out river.com today or the link below in the description. River is our preferred place to purchase Bitcoin. Now, when you're buying Bitcoin, guys, there are several considerations. Number one, should I be using an exchange? Is the exchange custodying their own Bitcoin? Is the exchange using platforms to custody that we don't know? Is the exchange leveraging its Bitcoin for other purposes? Well, with River, we know that River does not use leverage of any kind. River also uses its own multi-sig solution so that your Bitcoin are not held by anybody else. So it's a very important thing to understand about what River offers. Now, River also has Lightning Network integration and a lot of other really exciting features. Go check out river.com today.
Wonderful. And we will explore more your worldview and your work with AI as we proceed forward. But we are incredibly passionate about monetary matters as well. I'm a student of Milton Friedman. And I brought you on today because we want to talk mostly about the Japanese yen, the Chinese yuan, and the international monetary system. Yeah. So let's start with the latest out of Japan. Of course, Japan is experiencing a steady devaluation of its currency. It intervened in the market significantly this week. Yeah. Maybe you can just give us an overall view of what's happening in Japan, why the deval, how much you anticipate defense, and your overall Japanese view.
Well, I think the general story in terms of the Japanese yen has been one of, one has to separate between what we call on the one hand the nominal exchange rate. That's the exchange rate we observe on our screens, the yen versus the dollar, the yen versus the euro, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the purchasing power of the yen. So what is happening to the yen if we adjust the currency for relative price developments? So what we are seeing is that while the yen has been relative steady for the past three decades, in nominal terms, vis-a-vis, for example, the dollar, it has continued to decline in real terms. And the reason for this is that while we in Europe and in the US have had around 2% inflation since the mid-90s, of course, recently we have seen much higher inflation, but also a period of below 2% inflation, in Japan, we saw near three decades of deflationary pressures. And so what we have seen there is essentially that the erosion of purchasing power in Japan has happened in that sense, that or not the international value of, rather I should say, of the yen has happened in that sense. But recently, of course, that has changed. That has changed from being a real depreciation to both being a real and a nominal depreciation. And that's obviously why people are suddenly saying, what is going on with the yen? But if you look at the yen, the trend in the yen over the past year has been, the depreciation has been faster than normally. But the long-term picture over the past three decades is actually just for the steady decline in the yen. And my view on that is that, well, it's essentially a structural issue. The Japanese economy has been growing very slowly since the 90s. And the reason for that mostly has been negative demographics. If we look at Japanese productivity growth, it hasn't been that negative. It has actually been more or less on par with Europe. But it's the negative demographics. It's the steady decline of the labor force in Japan. And as a result of that, very low absolute real GDP growth. And that's really, in my view, what we are seeing now. So the long-term depreciation of the yen is driven, in my view, mostly by negative demographics.
Okay, so a structural change, a structural long-term change in Japan driving the weakening yen. Go ahead.
Maybe I could add to that, that of course that there is a change now, is that it's over the past decade, monetary policy has been changed in Japan. It has become, from a period prior to 2008, essentially the Japanese central bank never really was serious about getting inflation back to, for example, 2%. But prior to 2008, the central bank of Japan, the Bank of Japan, didn't have an inflation target. It more or less just accepted this continuous deflationary pressures. But over the past decade or more, we have seen a change in monetary policy. Of course, the Bank of Japan introduced a 2% inflation target, and the way the Bank of Japan has tried to meet this target, and of course now inflation is way above the 2%, has been to try to keep bond yields low, essentially buying Japanese treasury bonds, so to keep long-term yields at zero. What is happening now is, of course, that real natural interest rates globally has been rising for all kinds of reasons, and meaning that then what we call the natural interest rate, where interest rates are when the economy is in balance, has been increasing. So if you keep trying to keep your nominal interest rates at zero while your natural interest rate is going up globally, then that's essentially more monetary easing. And that is my view is what is causing the yen depreciation to accelerate over the past year. And of course, recently it has seemed rather dramatic. Again, I would like to caution that I am not one of those. I don't like the term currency crisis. You can't have a currency crisis when you have a floating exchange rate. You can have all kinds of economic crises that lead you to have a depreciation of your currency. But the weakening of the currency in of its own is not a crisis. It's the weakening of the yen is a structural issue over the longer run in real terms. But then you have an acceleration of the weakening of the yen, which is partly driven by the monetary choices of the Bank of Japan. Obviously now, the Bank of Japan would need to move towards tighter monetary policy, not because the yen is weakening, but because inflation is overshooting their 2% inflation target. The Bank of Japan never had a 4% inflation target. So we are now at a situation where the inflation has been above 4. We are now coming down to around 3%. So we are above the target. So there are good reasons why the Bank of Japan should go, quote unquote, normalize monetary conditions. And I believe with that, we would also see some stabilization. The paradox here is, of course, it is not the Bank of Japan doing the intervention in the currency markets. It's the Ministry of Finance, the Treasury, is the Japanese Treasury doing the intervention. And this is, by the way, a division of labor that we have in many, many countries. We have the same in most European countries and the same in the US. So take the case of the US. It is the US Treasury which have the kind of responsibility in terms of the level of the dollar, while the Federal Reserve has the responsibility in overall monetary policy. Obviously, this makes no sense at all. You cannot choose to have to split these two things up. You cannot say we want to have this level of inflation and we want to have a level of the currency that is completely divorced from that. But the Bank of Japan and the Treasury, or the Ministry of Finance, as it is called in Japan, is in a kind of headlocks here, that they have two different policy views. That the Bank of Japan essentially is not too worried about the inflation, is believing it's coming down. But on the other hand, the Ministry of Finance don't like the currency to weaken. And so the story here, of course, is a political one. That from my point of view, if you have a floating exchange rate, you should accept whatever level of the currency that the market determines your currency to be on. Sometimes the currency is telling policymakers and the public in general about the state of the economy. But imagine a situation where we had deflation in Japan. We're not there now. But imagine we were there. Then it would be desirable to ease monetary policy to stabilize the price level or get 2% inflation. And it would follow naturally from that policy that would get a desirable weakening of the currency. Obviously, if you are overshooting your target as you are now, then the weakening of the currency is not desirable, or rather it's a consequence of your monetary policy. But you know, the advice I would give to central bankers is completely ignore the level of the currency. It's not your target. Some countries in the world, of course, have exchange rate targets. In my native country of Denmark, we have a currency, the Danish krona, that is pegged to the euro. So the Danish central bank has only one target, and that is ensure the stability of the Danish krona against the euro. But consequently, of course, then the Danish central bank cannot have an inflation target. It follows then directly from the target of the exchange rate. You can't have both. You cannot have one currency target and one inflation target. They have to be, you can have a situation where they're in conflict with each other. And obviously, for many years, Bank of Japan refused to ease monetary policy enough to avoid deflation. The currency was stable, and most Japanese was probably happy with that situation. But it created all kinds of problems, that you had a continuous deflation, you created debt problems, you created property market bubbles, or problems, not bubbles, the opposite, and so forth, that was unwarranted. So you had a situation now that that we have moved away from that. But the alternative hasn't been spelled out. It's not entirely clear what politicians in Japan want, that they don't want the currency to weaken, but they don't want to go back to deflation either. So, you know, the policy regime doesn't seem to be completely fixed. Finally, when we look at public sentiment, it is often so that when you're watching your currency weaken, the public sees this as a sign of weakness of economic policy in general and will blame the government. And therefore, you often have this tendency, particularly in quite open economies, as the Japanese economy is, it's significantly more open than the US, for example, that you have a focus on, oh, the currency is weakening, therefore there has to be something wrong with the economy. And I think that, first of all, I would say the currency has been weakening for 30 years in real terms. It's now just weakening now substantially in nominal terms. And it's a reflection of, one, the structural issue, and two, of the monetary policy choices made by the Bank of Japan. And I do not on its own find the weakening of the currency alarming.
Great. And so I want to ask you then about the interest rate differential. So when you describe the natural interest rate around the world increasing,
yeah,
while Japan simultaneously has a relatively lower growth rate due to demographic issues,
yeah,
is that the economics 101 that you're talking about that drives that, where it's just an interest rate differential, so money flows out of the lower interest rate yen into other global currencies? Can you go into more of the basics?
So one thing is that, let's say you have a global level of natural interest rates, and then you have a difference vis-a-vis that in different countries, driven by differences in growth, differences in savings, differences in investments, and so forth. So what we have seen is, of course, global natural interest rates have been going up, and it's gone up for different reasons. In my view, trend growth is actually accelerating. I talked about AI before. There are also other reasons. I have actually highlighted anti-obesity medicine. Being a Dane, I can't help, of course, talking about Novo Nordisk and Ozempic and Wegovy, which are anti-obesity medicine, which is, in my view, contributing to increasing, significantly increasing trend growth in, for example, in the U.S., where close to half of the population is obese. That is having a tremendously positive underlying positive effect on the economy that we're doing something about obesity. We are seeing AI coming in globally and having a positive impact. Obviously, we're also seeing negative stories. We're seeing in the situation in Europe with very significant with the war in Ukraine, geopolitical tensions. We are seeing deglobalization trends. Those are negative, and those are likely negative for growth. But at the moment, I actually believe that particularly AI is contributing more positive than the negative factors to global growth. And then at the same time, we're seeing a decline in global savings. And those two things, declining global savings, a higher trend growth, is pushing up real natural interest rates. And if you're then trying to keep interest rates just steady, that is essentially monetary easing. We're seeing a little bit of the same thing in the US. Why is it that 10-year bond yields in the US has gone from essentially 4 to close to 5 without causing a recession, without causing the US stock market to plummet? Well, it's because this is mostly driven by higher natural interest rates. It's simply trend growth that is going up, so the world looks more bright. And that should push up interest rates without causing any havoc. But when your policy is one that is specifically directed at keeping yields at zero, as it is in Japan, so when real natural interest rates are going up and you're keeping your interest rates steady, you're essentially easing monetary policy, because the only way to keep interest rate low is to print more money. And so just a pure expectation of this will cause your currency to weaken. And so I think this is, as you said, it's Econ 101.
Okay, so I want to ask you then about the genuine inflation target at the from the Japanese. And you make an important point about the difference between the Bank of Japan, which is setting monetary policy and involved in the manipulation of interest rates, because the Bank of Japan is the body that buys JGBs, the Japanese government bonds. But then you have the Ministry of Finance, which is the Treasury Department in Japan, conducting currency intervention. So let's just talk about the currency intervention side of things then.
Yeah.
Why is the government coming in to intervene? An important question, Lars, I have for you that a lot of our viewers want to understand. We know that they buy treasuries when they relieve pressure on the yen, but are they selling treasuries explicitly when they defend the yen? So is it a one-to-one relationship, or are they in the swap market?
They will just be selling foreign currency. But all their holdings of they do probably do both, but they can operationally do both essentially it doesn't matter. Whatever they own that they can exchange for foreign for Japanese denominated currencies or assets, that could be the Japanese yen, or it could be yen denominated bonds. They just need to do that. They can do it whatever way they do it. And obviously, currency transaction or currency intervention is often done purely from currency to currency. So they're likely primarily selling dollars and buying yen, or euros or Swiss franc or pounds or whatever they will get their hands on.
Okay, so then when it comes to the intervention at the government level, what is the decision process? Are they fighting against the Bank of Japan, or are they? Is it just a miscommunication, or policymakers unsure of what to do?
There is what economists sometimes call the fear floating, that you have a floating exchange rate, but you fear facing the consequences of having a fear floating. And you're essentially trying to fight your own policy. You know, the government has not been arguing that monetary policies in Japan is too easy. But it arguing the currency is too weak, which obviously you can't have both. And so this is what in economic theory is called the Tinbergen rule. You know, you cannot have, if you have one instrument, you cannot have more than one target. And the instrument here is to print money or print less money or suck up liquidity. So it's controlling the supply of money in the economy. And essentially the government cannot print money. The central bank can do that, but it can exchange money. And that is what it has, some reserves on hand, and it can do that reserve. It can also, and then when it gets complicated, it can actually ask the Bank of Japan to do those operations for it, because it has the mandate regarding the currency rate, which seems paradoxical, and it is paradoxical, but it's not unusual that we're seeing this, and it's often argue that, yeah, the kind of argument you have, Lars, is right, but what they're trying to do is stabilize irrational speculative moves in the currency. And sorry for swearing, but that's complete bullshit. The price of the currency is determined by the market. The price or the currency rate reflect expectations of policy and economic structures. Sometimes the markets are right, sometimes the markets are wrong. But underlyingly here, nothing is happening in the currency here that is unexplainable or seems speculative. Obviously, there is a discussion, and we can return to that, over China. Will China devalue its currency? And obviously, both being heavily linked countries trade-wise and both being Asian currencies in the same economic sphere, a larger devaluation of the Chinese yuan would put pressure on the yen to depreciate. So some of the movement we're seeing in the yen likely reflects those speculations. But again, I would also like to stress, if we look at the movement in the Japanese yen over the past 12 months, it has moved a little bit more than one standard deviation compared to the normal. So it's still a little bit outside of the normal, the year-on-year move, but we have many years over the past 30 years where it has weakened by the same amount as it has now. So I think it's actually, I think one of the things that people hasn't caught on to is that yen has been so stable against the dollar for so relatively many years, and the real depreciation has happened via relative inflation rather than nominal move. Now, the situation is that we're seeing the nominal movements, and that is causing people to react. We have actually, what we will see is that if countries of similar economic structures and income levels, so let's say the Eurozone, the UK, Japan, Canada, the US, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway. These are all countries with same kind of income levels, same kind of economic structures in terms of being free market, democratic, open economies, with all of them with inflation targets around 2%. All of them. So in a situation where there is no major disturbances to the global economy or to any individual country, even though you have floating exchange rate, you should expect those currencies to be relatively stable vis-a-vis each other. And that is what we were used to doing, what economists have called the Great Moderation. So from the early to mid 90s and until 2008, and actually it continued after 2008. So when then one country was very different, that was Japan, having deflation while everybody else had 2% inflation. Now Japan has gone from having below everybody else in terms of inflation rates to be above, or the shift is actually bigger. And so you're going to have a movement in the currency. The former IMF chief economist, economics professor, the German-American economist, Rüdiger Dornbusch, unfortunately deceased, long ago taught us all about his overshooting model, exchange rate overshoot model, that exchange rate tends to overshoot if you have a change in monetary policy. And the reason there is overshooting in currencies is that pricing can't change. So if a central bank eases monetary policy, you could have the adjustment in your real exchange rate either by changing in inflation or in the exchange rate. But when you announce, I will ease monetary policy tomorrow, the exchange rate will move today. But since prices are sticky, consumer prices will only move later. And so when you go from essentially targeting minus 1% inflation or targeting deflation de facto for 2-3 decades and saying, now we're moving to 1%, now we're moving to 2% inflation, now we're accepting 3-4% inflation. And when we're at above 3% inflation, we are signaling, well, we are in no hurry to get back to 2% inflation. You're essentially telling markets, our real inflation target might be somewhere between 3-4%. And if the Fed is serious about getting back to 2%, the ECB is happy about being at 2%, then we should enter a period of consistent nominal depreciation of the yen. So if Japan has a higher inflation target de facto than the US or the Europe, the yen should also nominally continue to depreciate. And if the market decides that that's the case, you would see overshooting relative to that and get that move relatively fast. I think there's some of that reflected in that. But again, I don't want to overstate the movement in the yen as something. It's not a crisis, because a crisis is when you have a fiscal situation where you can't pay your bills, or where your banks collapse or household can't service their debt. But most of the debt the Japanese households have, and banks and the government, is yen denominated. There isn't a problem. They don't have to. So you would have a problem if you were a typical emerging markets in the 80s. So when you had in the 1980s, we had the Latin American sovereign debt crisis. A lot of those countries funded themselves by issuing debt denominated in dollars. So if your currency weakens in that situation, you can't service your debt because you have to service it in a foreign currency that is now becoming more and more expensive. But if you have to service your debt in your own currency, which you, by the way, print yourself, the level of the currency has no meaning at all in terms of that. So it's not creating a crisis. What this is it's a reflection of something going on in the economy. The crisis in the Japanese economy is negative demographics, and it's been with us for 30 years, and there's no signs that it's getting worse. There's a change in the inflation target from the Bank of Japan, tolerance towards inflation maybe being above 3%. And that's what is creating this. And then, of course, the speculation over a possible Chinese devaluation.
Okay, so Lars is making his point very clear that Japan is not in a currency crisis whatsoever, that the exchange rate movements are well explained by the fundamentals, long-term fundamentals of relative inflation, relative interest rates. So it's not a currency crisis in Japan, but is this a currency war now? Bring in China and explain to us, as if we were just taking your class for the first time, what's going on with the Chinese currency? Will it devalue? And my big question to you, Lars, is do you see a situation in which China has to float its currency? Because like you said, there's only one thing that you can target. You can't target inflation and peg the FX.
Yeah, and so I think China is Japan with a 20 to 30 year lag. We have seen a 30-year decline in the labor force in Japan. We have seen around 15 years actually now decline in the labor force in China. But China still had a lot of structural catching up. So despite negative demographics, China has been able to keep very significant growth rates. But we all know now that 30 years of misallocation in the real estate market in China, combined with negative demographics, combined with the fact that investors are waking up to the situation that China might not be a country that reflects private property, the rule of law, contracts, and so forth, that is actually leading a lot of investors to reevaluate whether they want to be invested in China. All of these factors are contributing, in my view, to a very, very steep decline in trend growth in China. In my view, and I have written about this over the past decade, or more than a past decade, that we are approaching a situation where real trend growth in Japan likely will hit zero within a regional short time span. And then we're already there in Japan. So in growth terms, China is now becoming Japan. Therefore, we should expect, economists sometimes call this the Balassa-Samuelson effect. Normally, we talk about it in the opposite direction. High growth economies should see their currencies appreciate. For the slightly older listeners, they will remember when we talk about the BRICS in the 2000s in a positive sense. We should all buy Brazil, we should buy Russia, we buy India, we should buy China, because these countries have high real growth rate. They were catching up, they were doing reforms. And consequently, we should see a real appreciation of the currencies in those countries. And that was partly happening. Now we're in the opposite situation for all of these countries, with the exception of India, is that they're seeing a significant slowdown in real GDP growth, in productivity growth, combined with a rolling back of economic reforms, which means that they should depreciate in real terms. However, if you have a currency that underlyingly structurally should depreciate, and you don't allow that, you have to intervene. You have to take out money from the economy to stop that depreciation. And when you do that, you slow growth from the demand side of the economy, and you accelerate deflationary pressures. And that, in my view, is partly what has been happening in China. And so China has these increasingly strong structural depreciation trends. And if the People's Bank of China, or rather the Chinese Communist Party, do not accept or say, well, let the market determine the exchange rate, then it will create a deflationary crisis. And a deflationary crisis is not something you want to have in a highly leveraged economy where you already have a property crisis. And that's Japan 30 years ago, and China is not going to play out the same thing. So the choice, the policy choice in China is not easy if it was a democratically high income country with strong social structures, trusting government, it wouldn't be a big deal. The currency would just gradually appreciate and reflect lower trend growth. But China is not like that. The Chinese Communist Party's claim to fame is 30 years of economic miracle and the catching up to high income economies. We're still far from having caught up, but that's when the Chinese Communist Party tells its people, tells the Chinese public, why should we rule this country? It's because we deliver. We deliver social stability, economic stability, and economic growth. And when you're not there, then if you allow your currency to weaken, the weakening of the currency will flash on the screen. You might censor the internet, but you can't censor the currency rate. And so when you have that situation, it will be flashing to everybody in China that something is wrong with the economy when you have this weakening of normally of the yuan. And that's why, you know, there's a lot of discussion. Oh, they will allow the yuan to depreciate or not. Sorry, I have been advising countries on currency policy. And I know that in totalitarian countries, nobody knows what the totalitarian decision makers will decide. This is not something that is out in the open. Very few people will decide in China about what is happening. This is not how monetary policy is determined in the US. In the US, you know, we have the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve is numerous Fed districts with all their independent presidents. And we have Fed officials talking out in the open about what they think and discussing in the open. You have hundreds, actually thousands of economists working in the Fed systems, and they all share their views in bars, at a football game. You know, it's coming out. But that's not how decision-making is in a totalitarian centralized government. And so nobody knows whether the People's Bank of China will devalue next week or wait 3 years. But what we do know is that trend growth is coming down in China. It's coming down relatively fast. And if the yuan is not allowed to weaken in nominal terms, the alternative is more deflation. And with more deflation, you have more debt problems. With more deflation, you have more property market problems. So you are between a rock and a hard place if you're a policymaker in China.
It's a very interesting dynamic that they have to deal with. They are faced with a battle of deflation or letting the currency depreciate. If they let the currency depreciate, they face potential social unrest as the people see that as a sign of weakness. If there's deflation, there's potential social unrest because the Chinese people have the vast majority of their wealth in property itself. So what should China be doing from a policy perspective? What is your expectation?
Well, I think unfortunately we will have more of the same. I think that they will be trying to keep on holding on to this. They might adjust their exchange rate regime gradually. Let's say if I was advising the Chinese government, I would strongly argue that they need to gradually allow for a complete floating of the yuan. They should get rid of currency and capital controls. That, however, in the present situation, will cause the currency to weaken probably substantially. And that might not be warranted from the perspective of general social stability. But on the other hand, you can do something about that by doing something structurally to ensure that the slowdown in China stops. And I'm talking about the structural slowdown. So that would mean opening of the economy, strong policy measures to reestablish credibility. And so the problem for the Chinese is that global investors now fear that China is essentially the same kind of state that Russia. And if that's your fear, you don't want to put a factory in China to produce cell phones. You want to take it out. And we're seeing that investors are scaling back investments in China. You know, you want to get back that money. You want to tell people, well, this is a country with the rule of law, with the respect for private property, with the respect of contract. We are protecting foreign investors' interests. When they put money in here, we will not come and take away that that property and so forth. We have no evil intentions vis-a-vis Taiwan. We're not going to invade our neighboring country and so forth. And we can all see that the rhetoric of the Communist Party since President Xi became president a decade ago has moved in the complete opposite direction of that. The Chinese Communist Party has moved from, at that point, more than 20 years of moving in a pro-free market direction, gradually also political liberalization, moderately so, very moderately so, but at least moving in that direction, to becoming increasingly hostile towards the West, increasingly hostile towards free markets, and clearly becoming more authoritarian. And it's now very hard to convince the international investors that that is not something that is here to stay. Obviously, the problem for the Communist Party and for President Xi is that what he needs to do is to pursue a policy of liberalization, politically and economically. But that means letting go of power. And I think this is actually, I have been working professionally with emerging markets for two decades. And I think going back in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was this feeling that everybody was moving towards more economic reform. You know, everything was becoming more democratic. Everybody was moving towards free markets. We are removing capital restrictions. We are removing subsidies. We are moving towards free trade and so forth. And that was what we were seeing. And a lot of presidents, and I would like to highlight two, Vladimir Putin in Russia and Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey. In the early 2000s, they were seen as economic reformers. We all expected them to do more economic reforms. I was among those who were cheerleading for that. However, that lasted a little bit more than a decade. And after 2008, we have been presidents like authoritarian inclined presidents like Vladimir Putin became authoritarian because he realized, if I move further ahead of economic reform and political reform, somebody will blame me when growth stops and I'm out. I need to move in the other direction. And it's, to me, it's very clearly the same calculation that President Xi and the communist leadership in China is having. This is like, this analysis is that we can't move further towards economic freedom, towards political liberalization, because then we'll lose power. So liberalization was great as long as it made people happy and as long as they kept on supporting us. But guess what? When people are not starving anymore and they have their necessities, at some point they'll say, why can't I vote in the same way as they do in the US or in Germany or in the UK? Why can't I express my views? Why can't I move freely around in the country? There's still limitations on that in China. And so why can't I do that? And the paradox for the dictator or wannabe dictator is that when you're getting more wealthy, you will actually have the opposite. You will not have happy people. You will have people that demand more freedom. So they're trying to find a dictator's sweet spot where the economy will not go into decline, but where they're trying to avoid reaccelerating economic reforms. And I think that's one of the reasons why, and I think actually a key reason why Vladimir Putin decided to go to war in Ukraine was, well, let's drum up nationalism. Let's become more nationalistic. We've seen the same with Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, like going back and forth between reformist, democratic, and authoritarian and market intervention or interventionist. And of course, in China, it's very clear over the past decade that the choice has been made. No more reforms.
And what are Yellen and Blinken asking Chinese policymakers when they go there? So we've had trips. What are they, behind closed doors, what is your assumption that the U.S. wants out of China? What's the relationship there? What's your view on the Cold War?
Yeah, and that's another thing is that the U.S. Treasury Department and by the way, U.S. policymakers in general, or I rather say U.S. politicians in general, have a very little understanding of floating exchange rates. That why we have floating exchange rate, that currency should be allowed to weaken a lot or strengthen a lot, depending on economic conditions and what economic shocks there are in the economy. So the U.S. Treasury makes regular assessments of whether currency rates are manipulated, and which makes absolutely no sense. The dollar has often been manipulated in the sense that we have just been through a period of very high U.S. inflation. That is manipulation of your currency. That's how you get inflation. That is by printing a lot of money. And by the way, the way you manipulate a currency is by printing a lot of money or doing the opposite. And so, but U.S. policymakers really don't like floating exchange rates either. So even though I believe that the right advice to the Chinese would be, let markets determine your exchange rate, implement more economic reforms, likely Yellen and particularly Blinken will show up and say, let's keep some stability. And they would not like to see a depreciation or weakening of the yuan. And obviously that would also play into the hands of U.S. domestic politics, because a devaluation of the yuan would cause Republicans or particularly Donald Trump to scream foul and say, we need to do the same thing, but we don't want to devaluate our currency. We have high inflation. So we wanna punish China for devaluing. We want to have more tariffs. We want to have a trade war. And so Trump would like nothing more than a Chinese devaluation. And obviously the Chinese knows this. So that is, of course, also impacting their decisions. But in my view, a world where we had truly floating exchange rate would be a more stable global economic environment than one where we're trying to manipulate exchange rate for political reasons.
Is there a large fear of the impact on global markets if we get a large and sudden deval out of China? So what would be the knock-on effects for, let's say, the US stock market if China came out tomorrow and fixed the one at 8, let's just say?
I think if it did that, that would be global monetary easing. So paradoxically enough, it would seem dramatic, but it would cause U.S. stock markets to rally, because it was essentially, it would cause stock markets to rally. It would cause gold prices to rise, copper prices to rise. Obviously, that is some of what we've been seeing. The markets apparently might be actually pricing this in, and obviously if we had a one-off devaluation and said we're fixing it at a new level, I doubt that would be the kind of policy. I think what People's Bank of China would do is probably just move towards a regime of gradually widening the fluctuation band, which isn't an official fluctuation band, but just allow gradually for more fluctuations. And obviously that would push the yuan weaker. But I don't think that would be necessarily sending shockwaves through the markets. If it was a major, let's say a 20% devaluation and said, now we are weaker 20% and we peg it here, then the second largest economy in the world would have significantly easier monetary policy. That would be a significant boost to global demand. It would create inflationary pressures around the world. And obviously, that might be one of the reasons why we are seeing some of the things we're seeing on interest rates moving up, even though I should say that notable, if we look at, and you are old fixed income trader, if you look at TIPS, the move we have seen, I should say, index inflation-linked bonds, if we look at inflation expectations in the bond market, it's not really going up. What is going up is real interest rates. And so, again, there is not a story in the markets that we're seeing significant fears of inflationary, global inflationary shock from China. So again, markets are probably pricing in some way of gradual moving towards this, but this one-off 20% devaluation or something like that, I do find that relatively unlikely. And I would also argue unnecessary. What China needs is not a devaluation on its own. It needs to move towards a more floating exchange rate. And doing that would likely cause the yuan to gradually weaken. But what it needs to do is to spur economic growth. And it can only do so from economic political liberalization, moving back toward a rule-based foreign policy, a friendly relationship with the West, and cool down the, you know, or turn down that very aggressive stance toward Taiwan. And if China did that, you would have a swift rebound in economic growth in China. And by the way, a significant easing of any pressures on the currency.
And what Lars is suggesting also is that while that is his policy suggestion, President Xi Jinping has shown the opposite, a quest for more power, a denial of liberalization of the economy. And so going the other way, it's going to present an interesting dynamic. Lars, yeah. I want to ask you a few questions to close all at once. You mentioned here that we have strengthening trend growth in the West due to AI. So let's bring that back in now.
Yeah.
You say we have a decline in trend growth in China that is secular, more a long-term secular. So there's a difference there. So strong relative growth in the West due to AI and other factors. We also have a deep German recession right now, as well as some cracks in the labor market in the US, but of course, we're still in positive growth. So what's your outlook on the US economy? Is recession in the cards here in the next 12 months or so? And keeping in mind Germany, and then talk to us about AI and the productivity gains are there.
Yeah, I think, you know, the way I normally talk about it or have been talking about it recently is that, you know, going back to April 2021, I wrote up a blog post on my blog, marketmonitorist.com, where I argued that we would see double-digit US inflation. Due to very significant monetary easing. I was very happy to be right about that. I was not very happy about inflation. I was very happy to be right about the forecast. And we saw that spike in inflation. And what I feared in 2021 and partly in 2022 was that policymakers, both in Europe and in North America, was essentially moving back to a 1970s paradigm, that it was these... let's call them Volcker Keynesian policies. I don't think Keynes would have approved, but you know, very 70s style economic policies, insanely easy fiscal policies, increased intervention in labor markets and product markets, regulations spreading around the world, and then monetary policy trying to keep growth going despite of these the policy mistakes. And so I thought we were going to, you know, I feared that we're returning to the 70s. But at the same time, yes, we had then that spike in inflation. But the realization that this was not the right policy came relatively fast. So we have talked about this. Was inflation transitory or not? No, inflation was not transitory, or the change in the US price level and the European price level was not transitory. But it was transitory in the way that the policies were transitory, that we didn't continue to have 40% M2 growth in the US, for example, as we have seen. The Fed said, okay, we have overdone it. We're scaling back this. We are going back, signaling clearly that we're going back to try to get to 2% inflation. And markets accepted that the Fed was serious about that. So there wasn't... Fed credibility didn't break down, at least not in any major sense. And at the same time, we have seen this underlying AI revolution that essentially started, in my view, back in 2017, where we essentially had the discovery, the scientific discovery of large language models, or the theory behind large language models. And so this whole optimism of between AI optimism, I believe is 100% correct. I'm extremely bullish on AI as a technology, and I think it will transform our societies in a tremendously positive direction and will boost productivity growth. And I think we're beginning to see that already playing out, particularly in the US and to a lesser extent in Europe. And with that, we move from the 70s through the 80s, where we were tightening monetary policy and getting inflation down, to the 90s with high productivity growth in 3 years. So 3 decades in 3 years. And now we might be in the 90s, but being in the 90s does not mean we cannot run into recessions again. And one of the challenging things is here that the Fed insists on conducting monetary policy by controlling interest rates. And I think that instrument is problematic when your natural interest rate is changing because of demographics. So one of the things that happened probably in the late 90s was productivity growth was going up. In the US, we also have very positive immigration rates in the US and strong population growth in the US and in labor market growth in the 90s, exactly as is happening now, which was causing the real natural rate interest rate to go up, which caused the Fed to have too easy monetary policy in the later part of the 90s. And that, of course, then led to the IT bubble or the tech bubble or whatever we call it. So a real thing became a bubble. And obviously there's a risk the same thing happens now, or it just becomes regular inflation or misallocation of capital. I'm not that concerned that is happening now. But again, I have quoted Rudiger Dornbusch once. I might as well quote him once more. Rudiger Dornbusch once said that U.S. upswings or recoveries do not die of old age. They are killed by the Federal Reserve. And I think that's very much the fear, is that the Fed kind of had this feeling, as many market participants, this can't go on forever. This has to end. But the only one who will end this is the Fed. And not by, I think that monetary policy in the U.S. is slightly too easy at the moment. And the way I like to look at that is to look at nominal GDP growth. And the indicators for forward-looking indicators for nominal GDP growth is that we are likely growing just around 5% nominal GDP growth in the US. With trend growth at 2.5%, that is getting you to 2.5-3% inflation. That's above your target. On the other hand, if trend growth is 3%, then 5% nominal GDP growth will get you to 2% inflation. I think the jury is still out on where we are on that. But we are not at 4% underlying inflation or at 5%, and we're not moving towards 5% or 6% inflation. So there's no reason for the Fed to panic. I think the FOMC meeting yesterday, more or less, was right on where it should be in terms of the communication. If we don't have to change the entire framework, that is. Yes, we have some inflationary pressures, but that is, I would advise don't look at month on month changes in CPI or PCE. Look at forward looking indicators of inflation. We are actually seeing bond market inflation expectations being tremendously stable, as an actual been so, even through this whole episode. So markets are certainly not. We will venture back to the 70s. And therefore, there's no reason for the Fed to panic. I would be deeply worried if I saw inflation expectations moving up with real rates not moving at all. Then I would be worried. But when I see slightly above target inflation and very strong signs of strong productivity growth, well, I'm pretty certain that then productivity growth will keep inflation in check. Again, remember, if I look at money supply growth is still relatively modest. What is keeping inflation going up is actually a recovery in money velocity. And there is a limit to how much that can increase. So there's natural limits to how much stronger nominal demand can get in the present setting. So again, I'm not worried. So I'm actually in, I see a pretty benign scenario, even though I'm always lack any trust in central banks to do the right thing. But I'm not overly worried. Europe is clearly another matter. Europe is a matter where we have structural issues that are very, very significant. And you know, closing down your entire nuclear industry, as they did in Germany over a little bit more than a decade, and then becoming completely dependent on Russia for your energy resources, and producing essentially only cars and selling them to China, an economy that now is in deep structural crisis. Obviously, you will be in a similar crisis. So it's time for Germany to wake up. Germany badly needs to embrace the kind of economic reforms that we saw globally in the 1990s. But by the way, Germany is probably the high income country in the world that potentially could benefit the most from AI. No country in the developed world is more bureaucratic, is more paper heavy, is less technologically driven than Germany. If somebody could convince me that the German banking industry would now embrace digitalization, AI, machine learning, then I would be buying German banking equity stocks, by, you know, but I'm not sure they will, but they should. So there is a big potential in Germany, but it's not maturing yet. Scandinavia, Sweden is having similar problems because Sweden is a heavily industrialized country, also a car producer. And in fact, if you look at the European countries with a large car industry, Italy, France, Germany, Sweden, and the Czech Republic, they're all suffering. If you look at a country like Denmark, which is, beer, Carlsberg, toys, Lego, and diabetes and obesity medicine, Novo, then we're just doing great. We have been tremendously lucky in this country to have that product mixed. But you know, the European story is diverse. But surely the Europe's largest economy, Germany, is suffering and is in bad need of economic reform.
Lars Christensen, international economist, visiting us from Copenhagen Business School. Thank you so much for your tremendous insights from around the world of economics. We hope that you will join us again. We learned a lot.
I look forward to joining you again. It has been a pleasure to talk to you.
I wanted to get into the Latin debt crisis and relate it to the Asian financial crisis and talk about how those are maybe relatable in some ways, but not in others to the current period. So
yeah, maybe we should do one on the emerging market crisis and through history. That's always a good topic.
I would love that. So we'll definitely do that. Please tell people where they can find your writing online.
Well, I have my blog on the marketmonetarist.com. I do tweet on X, and I have quite a large following on LinkedIn. I mostly write in Danish on LinkedIn, but the translation there is very good. My English writing is mostly on my blog, marketmonetarist.com.
Excellent. Well, we'll include all the links in our show notes. Lars, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll catch you guys next time. Special thanks to River for sponsoring this channel. Purchase Bitcoin without any fees when you use River's DCA feature. River has become our trusted source of accessing the Bitcoin market because they don't use any third-party custodians. This is a very, very important thing to understand. River is not using another company to store the Bitcoin for them.
They have their own multi-signature solutions, which means that they have designed their own way to make sure nobody else has responsibility for the Bitcoin for the time that you have River hold your Bitcoin for you on their platform once you have purchased it. So go check out river.com today. Thanks for sticking with us as always at the Bitcoin Layer. Subscribe to our channel. Subscribe to our Substack at thebitcoinlayer.substack.com so that you can follow along our latest research and analysis.